So we are diving into the science of neonatal thermoregulation today.
Yes.
And our sources for this deep dive include the Health New Zealand Te Whatu Ora Waikato NICU Clinical Guidelines.
Right.
Specifically, it's a specialized nursing thermoregulation guide. And it features 10 core learning objectives.
Mm.
And we're also looking at some historical text detailing the evolution of infant incubators.
Yeah, the history is fascinating.
It really is. So the mission for this deep dive is to kind of translate these high-level clinical protocols into an engaging bedside actionable roadmap for NICU nurses.
Exactly.
We are going to uncover the physiological mechanisms that make, you know, these really specific temperature interventions the literal difference between life and death for premature infants.
Right. But before we get into the highly advanced algorithms and the humidity weaning protocols of the modern Waikato guidelines, those historical sources offer a rather jarring perspective on where this medical discipline actually began.
Oh, yeah.
Because modern neonatal care essentially traces its organized roots back to the Carnival Midway.
Right, which is just wild. Martin County is the central figure there.
Yes.
In the late 1890s and early 1900s, he exhibited premature infants in early incubators at international fairs in places like Coney Island.
Yeah, literally Coney Island.
And he charged the public admission to view them. It was a massive spectacle. People treated it as an attraction.
Mm.
There were literally popular songs written about the incubator babies that were sung in beer halls.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine today.
Yeah.
But while the environment was undeniably theatrical, County was proving a vital clinical point that the broader medical establishment had not yet fully embraced.
Right.
By providing meticulous, consistent thermal care, he demonstrated that these incredibly fragile infants could survive.
Yeah.
He established a baseline for thermal intervention decades before hospitals began building dedicated, organized preterm programs.
Wow.
So we've transitioned from spectator events to exacting evidence-based science. But the underlying premise is unchanged. You know, maintaining a specific thermal environment is the foundation of premature survival.
That makes total sense. And connecting that historical premise to the modern Waikato guidelines requires looking at the profound physiological deficits of the premature infant.
Right.
Because we know term babies born after 37 weeks arrive with a biological toolkit to handle the outside world.
Yes, they do.
They have insulating subcutaneous fat. They have the neuromuscular maturity to shiver, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they possess brown adipose tissue.
And that brown fat is critical. In a term baby, it makes up roughly 4% of their total body weight.
4%.
Yeah, 4%. And they utilize it for non-shivering thermogenesis.
Okay, so what does that mean exactly?
Well, when a term baby gets cold, their body metabolizes that brown fat to generate heat chemically.
Oh, I see.
But preterm infants, particularly those born at 32 weeks or earlier, or those weighing 1,600 grams or less, they simply do not have access to that process.
Wow.
The sources classify them as inefficient homeotherms.
Because they only possess about 1% to 2% brown fat.
It,
and furthermore, they lack the specific enzymes required to convert hormones for that chemical heat production.
Right.
Their subcutaneous tissue is essentially non-existent, meaning they have no physical insulation.
None.
So they are completely exposed to the physical forces of heat transfer in the room.
Yeah, and for a medical audience, the basic physics of radiation, conduction, and convection are well understood.
Sure.
The critical factor here is how those forces interact with the specific anatomy of an extremely low gestational age neonate, or an LGAN.
LGAN, right.
These infants possess a massive skin surface to body weight ratio. It is approximately 4 times that of an average adult.
4 times. Okay, let's unpack this. Think of the difference between a solid block of ice and crushed ice.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Right. A block of ice melts slowly because less of its mass is exposed to the ambient air.
Mm-hmm.
But crushed ice melts almost instantly because the surface area is vastly multiplied.
Right.
A preterm baby has massive surface area relative to their tiny mass, combined with an incredibly thin, highly permeable epidermis.
Yes.
So if they have all the surface area and thin skin, which of those 4 heat loss routes is the absolute worst enemy right after birth?
Oh, it's evaporation, without a doubt. The evaporative process is violent in those first moments.
Really? Violent?
Yes. Because a baby is born covered in amniotic fluid. As that fluid evaporates off their highly permeable skin, the heat transfer away from the body is massive.
Wow.
The sources indicate an infant can lose up to 200 kilocalories per kilogram every single minute through evaporative heat loss.
200 kilocalories per minute. That is just staggering.
It is.
So if that rate of heat loss isn't intercepted immediately, the baby's core temperature just crashes.
Instantly.
Setting off a cascade of metabolic failures, hypoxia, and eventually cardiac compromise.
Exactly.
So the medical team's battle against the physics of evaporation begins the exact second the infant is delivered.
Which brings us to the delivery room management. Specifically the Waikato stabilization bundle for those LJNs born at 28 weeks or less.
Okay, so what does that look like?
Well, the delivery room itself must be maintained at a warm 26 degrees Celsius.
Right.
The resuscitator is preheated to 100% capacity.
Okay.
But the most critical intervention alters the traditional sequence of birth entirely.
Right, because the standard practice of drying a newborn with a towel is abandoned.
Completely abandoned.
Because rubbing them with a towel would expose their immature epidermis to the air currents and accelerate the evaporative cooling.
Yes, exactly.
Instead, the Waikato guidelines mandate the infant is placed directly into a polyethylene occlusive wrap called a NeoHelp.
Right.
They go into the wrap completely wet, and cord clamping is deferred for 1 full minute.
Yeah. And the physics behind the NeoHelp wrap are brilliant in their simplicity.
It's like a sous vide bag, right?
That is exactly what it's like. It functions very much like a sous vide bag used in cooking. By trapping the amniotic fluid and moisture directly against the skin, the microenvironment inside that plastic wrap instantly reaches 100% humidity.
Right, so it eliminates the vapor pressure gradient.
Exactly.
Because the air immediately surrounding the skin is completely saturated, further moisture cannot turn into vapor.
Yes.
That massive 200 kilocalories per kilogram per minute evaporative drain is physically halted before it can deplete the infant's core temperature.
And once that delivery room golden hour is successfully managed and the infant is transferred to the NICU, the nursing objective shifts to maintaining a neutral thermal environment.
Okay, a neutral thermal environment.
Right. This is the precise ambient temperature where the infant can maintain a normal core temperature while expending the absolute minimum amount of energy and oxygen.
Because they need every ounce of that metabolic energy for cellular growth and healing.
Exactly.
Not for desperately trying to stay warm.
Right.
So what are the actual target numbers then?
The Waikato parameters define normothermia as a core temperature of 36.6 to 37.4 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
The ideal target being 36.6 to 37.2.
Right.
Hypothermia is classified as anything at or below 36.5.
Got it.
And hyperthermia is anything at or above 37.5 degrees.
So hitting that 37.5 degree hyperthermic threshold introduces one of the most dangerous clinical traps in neonatal care, right? The sepsis paradox.
Yes, the sepsis paradox.
Because in a standard pediatric or adult patient, a high temperature strongly indicates an immune response to infection.
Of course.
But in a small preterm infant, a high temperature is almost always the result of environmental overheating or dehydration.
Almost always.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we are so conditioned as humans to associate sickness with a fever.
Right.
I want to push on the clinical reality of this because medical professionals are heavily conditioned to view a temperature spike as a primary indicator of infection.
Absolutely.
If a nurse sees a 26-week-old infant reading 37.8 degrees on the monitor, the instinct to immediately rule out sepsis must be overwhelming.
It is.
You're saying for these tiny patients, we need to completely reverse our thinking. It feels counterintuitive to look at the incubator settings before assuming the baby is mounting an immune response.
The instinct is totally understandable, but acting on it prematurely causes immense harm.
Why is that?
Extremely preterm infants lack the mature immune systems and the metabolic reserve to mount a pyrogenic fever response.
Okay.
If the medical team treats a high temperature as a presumptive infection, it triggers a full septic screen.
And that involves drawing significant blood volumes from an infant who barely has any to spare.
Exactly.
Placing new 5V lines and potentially performing a lumbar puncture.
Yeah, and the physical stress of those procedures, combined with opening the incubator doors and destroying the controlled microenvironment, shatters the baby's thermal stability.
Just shatters it.
It exhausts their minimal metabolic reserves based on a false alarm.
Wow.
The true physiological presentation of sepsis in these tiny patients is actually the inverse.
Cold means sick?
Cold means sick. Septic preterm infants become hypothermic, or they exhibit what the guidelines call an increased environmental heat demand.
An increased environmental heat demand. That's a critical bedside metric.
Yes, it is.
So the baby's temperature might look completely stable on the monitor, like maybe it reads a perfect 36.8 degrees.
Right.
But the bedside nurse notes that the incubator has had to progressively increase its heat output over the past 4 to 6 hours just to maintain that 36.8.
Exactly. The baby is failing to defend their own temperature.
Oh, wow.
The microprocessor in the incubator is masking the infant's physiological collapse by pumping in more heat.
That is terrifying.
It is. And identifying that trend requires a deep understanding of how the incubator actually functions.
So, since environmental overheating is the main cause of hyperthermia, how do nurses actually control the incubator tech to keep temperatures perfectly stable?
Well, the bedside nurse really operates as a systems engineer in that regard.
Yeah.
The guidelines focus heavily on mastering the two primary operating modes of a modern incubator.
Okay, what are they?
Air mode, which is manual, and baby mode, which is a servo-controlled system.
Right.
Baby mode is designated as the standard for sick infants and any baby 32 weeks or under.
So how does baby mode actually work?
Baby mode relies on a continuous closed-loop feedback system.
Huh.
It samples the infant's skin temperature every 30 seconds.
Every 30 seconds.
Yeah, and based on those readings, it utilizes a cascade mode algorithm to manage the air temperature.
Okay.
It doesn't simply toggle the heating element on and off at maximum capacity.
Right, because blasting the chamber with maximum heat would cause rapid vasodilation in the infant.
Exactly.
Potentially tanking their blood pressure, followed by sudden vasoconstriction when the heat shuts off.
Yes.
It creates a thermal shock environment.
Which is very dangerous.
So cascade mode prevents that by restricting air temperature adjustments to a maximum of 0.3 degrees Celsius every 10 minutes.
Right. It creates a gentle, gradual thermal slope.
A gentle slope.
Yeah, but the entire cascade algorithm is entirely dependent on the integrity of the sensory data it receives.
Of course.
And that data comes from the skin temperature probe.
The probe.
So the Waikata guidelines detail a very strict sequence for probe application.
To make servo mode work, the skin probe has to be perfect.
Yes.
First, the nurse identifies the correct anatomical site, ideally over the liver, on the right upper quadrant of the abdomen, or on the flanks.
Right.
The probe is applied, secured with a specific silicone tape to protect the fragile epidermis, and finally covered with a specialized reflective patch.
And the material properties of that reflective cover are absolutely essential.
Why is that?
It acts as a shield against both the ambient air currents in the chamber and the radiant heat emitted by the incubator's heating elements.
Oh, I see.
If a nurse trims or alters that reflective cover, the thermistor begins reading the environmental temperature rather than the infant's actual skin temperature.
Never cut the reflective cover.
Never. Because the servo feedback loop becomes completely corrupted.
And a corrupted feedback loop is what leads to the entrapment hazard, right?
Yes.
If the infant rolls or is positioned in a way that traps the skin probe between their back and the mattress, the consequences are life-threatening.
Extremely.
Because the probe becomes insulated by the mattress on one side and the baby's core body heat on the other.
Right. And the localized heat causes the probe to rapidly increase in temperature.
Oh, no.
It sends an urgent signal to the microprocessor stating the baby is severely hyperthermic.
So the incubator thinks the baby is boiling.
Exactly. And the algorithm responds exactly as programmed. It immediately withdraws all heat support to cool the baby down.
So the monitor displays a falsely elevated temperature, reassuring the medical team, while the baby is secretly plunging into hidden hypothermia.
Yes. And simultaneously, the physical pressure of the tracked probe against the infant's highly vulnerable, underdeveloped skin creates a localized pressure point.
And given the lack of subcutaneous fat, that pressure point can quickly evolve into a severe necrotic tissue injury.
It's a disaster.
The positioning of a single sensor dictates the stability of the entire clinical picture.
It really does. But temperature management is ultimately only half of the equation within that microenvironment.
Yep. Thermoregulation isn't just about dry heat and sensors. It's about moisture, too.
Exactly. For the LGANs, the guidelines stipulate high incubator humidity, maintained between 80 and 90%. For the first 7 days of life.
80 to 90%.
Yeah. We mentioned the thin, highly permeable epidermis earlier.
Right.
The stratum corneum, which is the outermost layer of the skin, provides almost no barrier function in a severely premature infant.
So they just leak fluid.
Basically, yeah. High ambient humidity functions as a prosthetic epidermis.
A prosthetic epidermis.
Yeah, it minimizes transepidermal water loss, preventing the infant's intracellular fluid from leaching out and evaporating.
But keeping an infant in a 90% humidity environment indefinitely introduces secondary complications, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
So the Waikato protocol initiates a strict weaning schedule starting on day 8.
Yes.
Reducing the ambient humidity by exactly 5% every day.
Right.
The guidelines note day 9 targets exactly 70%, and by day 15, supplementary humidity is discontinued entirely.
And that gradual reduction is a physiological forcing function.
What do you mean by that?
Well, prolonged exposure to high moisture leaves the skin macerated.
Mm.
It becomes overly soft, structurally weak, and highly susceptible to bacterial and fungal colonization.
Oh, that makes sense. Like when you stay in the bath too long.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the daily 5% drop forces the epidermis to adapt to a drier environment, promoting keratinization and the development of the infant's own natural barrier function.
And as the skin keratinizes and the environmental controls are systematically dialed back, the clinical protocols introduce the human element.
Yes.
Kangaroo care, right. Skin-to-skin contact.
Right.
This is where the intense clinical technology meets the emotional reality of a parent finally getting to hold their fragile newborn.
It's a huge milestone.
But transitioning an infant out of the incubator for kangaroo care requires specific technical adjustments at the bedside, doesn't it?
It does. The bedside nurse must transition the incubator from baby mode to air mode, setting it to maintain the infant's average air temperature recorded over the previous 6 hours.
Right, so it doesn't just blast heat while the baby is out.
Because
leaving the incubator in baby mode while the infant is on the parent's chest would cause the sensors to read the empty, cooler room air.
Yeah.
The algorithm would panic, maximize the heat output, and the infant would be returned to a dangerously overheated chamber.
That'd be disastrous.
The guidelines also specify that LJANs who are 14 days old or younger must continue to wear their NeoHelp wrap during kangaroo care.
Right. The parent's chest provides excellent conductive and convective warmth, stabilizing the infant's heart rate and oxygenation.
Yeah.
However, at 14 days old, the LJAN still locks the epidermal integrity to prevent massive evaporative heat loss.
Oh, so they still need the wrap.
Yes. The polyethylene wrap maintains the moisture barrier while facilitating the physiological benefits of maternal or paternal contact.
So all of this careful management, from the delivery room wrap to the servo probes to the humidity weaning, it all leads to one ultimate goal, right?
Graduation.
Graduation to an open cot. The Waikato guidelines outline 4 strict, non-negotiable criteria the infant must meet before leaving the controlled microenvironment.
Right.
First, they must reach a weight of at least 1,600 grams.
Mm-hmm.
Second, achieve a corrected gestational age of at least 32 weeks.
Yep.
Third, demonstrate consistent normothermic axillary temperatures. And fourth, remain clinically stable.
And those 4 criteria directly address the physiological deficits we discussed at the very beginning of this deep dive.
They tie it all together.
Yeah. By reaching 32 weeks and 1,600 grams, the infant has acquired enough body mass, a fully functional and keratinized epidermis, and sufficient brown fat reserves to metabolically defend their own temperature against the physics of the outside world.
That is incredible. We have really mapped out the intense mechanical precision required to support that biological journey.
We really have.
From neutralizing evaporative heat loss in the delivery room with those occlusive wraps to identifying true sepsis versus environmental hyperthermia, managing cascade algorithms, and weaning humidity to force skin maturation.
Yeah.
It clearly demonstrates how specialized nursing interventions govern the survival of these infants. Understanding the why behind the protocols empowers nurses to provide life-saving care.
Absolutely. The reliance on microprocessors, servo-controlled environments, and continuous algorithmic feedback is the backbone of modern survival rates.
Yeah.
But you know, what's fascinating here is a detail from our historical sources that offers a profound contrast to our current methods.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In 1933, at a hospital in Boston, Dr. Blackfan and Yaglu achieved a significant reduction in premature mortality using a very different application of thermoregulation.
What did they do?
They didn't use individual microenvironments. They converted an entire nursery room into a single high-humidity walk-in incubator.
Wait, a walk-in incubator?
Yes. The nurses, the physicians, and the infants all occupy the exact same physical and thermal space.
Oh my gosh.
The caregivers were working full shifts, sweating it out in 80% humidity right alongside their patients.
I mean, talk about dedication. But it was a shared physiological experience.
Exactly, it was shared. And if we connect this to the bigger picture of our technological trajectory, it leaves us with something to ponder.
Yeah.
As our engineering allows us to perfectly isolate the premature infant inside a highly advanced robotic pod, separating their environment entirely from ours. what subtle elements of observation, care, and connection might change when the caregiver and the patient no longer share the same physical environment.
Wow, that is a really provocative thought to end on, because as our microtechnology gets more and more advanced, something fundamental about that human connection might just get lost in the process.
It's definitely something to think about.